Good afternoon, everybody. It's my pleasure today to have Tao Quan Get present. There's a brief bio and background on Tao's presentation here, but what stands out for me for Tao is I met Tao when I was a neonatology fellow, I think, actually, when I first came to Seattle, shortly after I came to Seattle, and he and I both worked on the Mindscape project, and he worked on the Ethnomed project, Mindscape being a web view of our medical data repository back in the mid-90s. And then Ethnomed being a resource on cross-cultural perspectives on health and disease that was developed outside of Harborview with Tao's immense help and, I would say, leadership on the informatics front.
Participation.
And currently, Tao is a medical epidemiologist in Seattle, King County. And one of the roles he plays among the many hats he wears is essentially dealing with the real-world data integration issues. And so today's talk is looking at what the real world of data integration and data flow in the context of pandemic flu surveillance, or swine flu, or H1N1 flu surveillance this year. So thanks, Cap.
Thank you very much.
So yes, as Peter said, I'd like to talk a little bit about what we've learned about public health informatics in the context of pandemic flu surveillance. You know, now that we've gone through two successive waves of novel influenza, 2009 H1N1, we have a chance to kind of sit back and think, okay, how did this system perform? You know, we were fortunate in that this pandemic strain was not the kind that wrought a lot of death and destruction the same way the 1918 pandemic did. So it gave us the opportunity to test systems that we've tried to create and put in place for a larger, more severe event. In a situation where the system was stressed, but not terribly so. So I work for Public Health Seattle King County. I'm a medical epidemiologist there. Originally, I was trained in pediatrics and did my pediatric residency here, and then yes, met Peter before I did my MPH here at UW, and then I practiced in the community for several years before joining Public Health in 2006. And we're located in downtown Seattle. And although we are, like any other health department, you know, under-resourced and underfunded, we do have some pretty impressive informatics there. This is our office. Any resemblance to the Starship Enterprise Bridge is totally coincidence. But actually, this is where most of us work, cubicle world. But nevertheless, we do have the chance to try out some different things. So the bread and butter of our work has to do with notifiable conditions, not influenza. So in the state of Washington, there are a set of conditions where if a healthcare provider or a laboratory diagnoses a patient with one of these conditions, they're required by law to let us know about that patient. And this is so that we can keep count of them, so that we can do any public health interventions to reduce the spread of disease. And as you can see, there's things from measles to rabies to animal bites to hepatitis A. So whenever one of these happens, one of these events happens, or somebody's diagnosed with illness, the idea is that somebody gives us a call. Well, first that the patient goes to a healthcare provider, and the healthcare provider diagnoses the patient with a notifiable condition, and that healthcare provider then calls us, and then we engage in control and prevention activities, and then share surveillance information with the healthcare community at large. So this is sort of, in simple terms, what our day-to-day work is. But for influenza, we had many other responsibilities as well. So before 2009, influenza was not a notifiable condition. You know, influenza was not on that table that I just showed you. Unless it involved the death of a child, we had no way of counting cases of influenza, except perhaps to do retrospective studies looking at hospital discharge databases. For the pandemic, we put into place a surveillance system where we had hospitals and healthcare providers report to us hospitalizations and deaths due to laboratory confirmed influenza. one disadvantage of these laboratory tests, like rapid antigen tests for influenza. So if you go to your healthcare provider with fever and a cough and a sore throat and chills, your healthcare provider might do a rapid test for influenza where they'll take a swab of your nose and throat and do a little test in the back of the office, and in 20 minutes or so be able to tell you if you have influenza. Unfortunately, those laboratory tests aren't very sensitive for 2009 H1N1. So if you had 100 patients with pandemic influenza 2009 H1N1 and did this rapid antigen test on them, maybe only 30 to 50 of them would test positive by the rapid test, even though they do in fact have the flu. So we also wanted to conduct surveillance for suspected deaths due to influenza, as well as intensive care unit admissions for patients with suspected influenza. We also wanted to describe who was getting infected, what were the risk factors for infection, who is at greatest risk for severe illness. And we also wanted to know, okay, when influenza is going through the community, what subtype is it? Is it the new pandemic strain, or is it a strain of seasonal influenza that looks identically in terms of the kinds of symptoms that it causes? We also wanted to track the impact of influenza on the population, particularly in children. And we'll talk a little bit about why children have a special role in the community in terms of influenza transmission. Now, all this data isn't any good if we don't do something with it, if we don't share it with others. So one of our important responsibilities was to create regular reports throughout the course of the pandemic to share with healthcare providers so that they could know what's happening in the community with influenza, as well as with the public. And you can go to our website. This is a kind of a long URL. We can also go to www.kingcounty.gov/health/H1N1, and that'll take you to our pandemic flu page. Let's see. Oh well, let's see. I won't show you the page now. So let's just go through what the characteristics of an ideal surveillance system are, and then we'll talk about the system that we have, and at the end of the talk, kind of grade ourselves in these different areas. And so this is a set of guidelines put out by the CDC, and you can go to CDC and do a search on surveillance system evaluation, and you'll be able to find this article if you want more details. But first, the ideal surveillance system is going to be simple. More complex systems are likely more expensive to maintain, have more moving parts that can break down. So simplicity is a value in and of itself. It has to be flexible as well. So if a system might do well trying to do surveillance for 10 cases a week, but if we have an outbreak where there are 100 cases a week, will the system still work? Or a system might be designed to track, say, two subtypes of influenza. But what if there are many different types of influenza? How will the system adapt? So we need some flexibility in the surveillance system as well. Of course, garbage in, you get garbage out. So we have to have accuracy. We have to have good data quality. And it has to be acceptable to users. We might think of all the great information we want to collect, but if we have a case report form that takes 3 hours to fill out, no healthcare provider is going to take the time from their busy day to do that. The ideal surveillance system also has to be sensitive. So if you have a group of people who have the disease that you want to do surveillance for, we need to be able to detect them, almost all of them, ideally. But we also want to be sure that we don't have any false positives, because any time that we do an investigation, when we call up the hospital to verify the diagnosis or call up the patient themselves to get more information on how they were exposed and their predisposing conditions, that takes time and resources. And so we don't want to spend a lot of time and resources chasing down false positives. The system also has to be representative. We could design a very nice system for influenza surveillance that takes data just from Children's Hospital, but that wouldn't be representative of the population at large. Or we might have hospitals participating, but they're all based in North Seattle. But then we wouldn't know what's happening in the rest of King County. So we need a system that is representative in terms of the population and its geography. We also have to have timely data if the surveillance system is going to be useful to guide public health intervention. It doesn't help to have the data available 2 months after things have occurred. We need things ideally in real time, or at least daily or weekly. And then finally, the ideal surveillance system needs to be stable. If it's crashing all the time, that's no good. Or if it's so complex that it requires 20 hours of maintenance a day, leaving only 4 hours of usability during the day, that's no good either. So by stability, we mean that the system is up and running when we need to use it. Just to talk a little bit more about flexibility in surveillance, in the course of an outbreak, the information needs for public health purposes change. So before an event happens, we really might just be detecting a small, minimal set of data. So with regards to influenza, we might just be looking at, say, the number of people who show up in emergency rooms with fever, cough, and sore throat. And we know that that won't catch everybody with influenza, and we know that many of those people might not have influenza. But we know that that the number of people with fever, cough, and sore throat goes up and down the same way influenza does. But once an outbreak occurs, and we see a rise in people showing up to emergency rooms with influenza symptoms, then we need to get more information. We need to find out, well, what laboratory tests confirm the diagnosis? How severe is your illness? Are they just coming to the emergency rooms and leaving? Are they coming into the hospital and being admitted to an intensive care unit? You might also want specific surveillance data for situational awareness. So for influenza, we might be interested in knowing, you know, what percentage of these patients also have asthma or diabetes or obesity, which is a new risk factor that was uncovered during the 2009 H1N1 outbreaks. And then you might have some targeted studies as well. So if there were an outbreak, say, amongst healthcare workers, and we were interested in knowing, well, what happened here? Was there an outbreak because there was a breakdown in how people were using personal protective equipment, you know, masks, gloves, et cetera? Or perhaps we're interested in finding out, okay, once this group of healthcare workers got infected, how long are they contagious for? Or we might also be interested in knowing, how is pandemic influenza impacting our pregnant patients? So these kinds of special investigations might be done in the course of an outbreak as well. So our surveillance system needs to be able to provide different types of information for different stages of an outbreak. So let me just walk you through the different components of the flu surveillance system at Seattle and King County. And right away, you can tell that our grade for simplicity probably is not going to be very good. But we need to have all these different components, given the technology we have now, in order to measure the different impacts on our community, and I'll explain that. So first, we might be interested in knowing, you know, how many people are coming to emergency rooms with flu symptoms. And so for that, we use our syndromic surveillance system. And the way this works is emergency rooms throughout the county, whenever you register and give the person at the front desk your chief complaint, I'm here for a broken arm or I'm here for a cough and fever, they enter that into their computer system. And then the hospital once a day sends us a line list of chief complaints as well as the age and gender and zip code of residence of each person. So it's de-identified, so we don't collect names, addresses, or protected health information. But you know, this is a typical table where each line represents a single patient
Here's somebody with vomiting who's 26 years old who came to Swedish Medical Center in Ballard. And they were not admitted to the hospital, but they had nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. So we have a computer program that takes these diagnoses and codes them according to different syndromes. So if you show up with, say, fever and cough or fever and sore throat, then and you show up on this line list, then our syndromic surveillance program will classify you as having an ILI, or influenza-like illness. So each day we collect this information from hospital emergency rooms. And here's a graph of the data that we collected from the beginning of 2009. So each line here represents a different age group. And you can see here at the beginning of 2009, say January, February, March, we had a mild seasonal influenza wave. Then at the end of April, we had a large spike in emergency room visits for influenza-like illness. And this is for young adults 18 to 44 years old, and also seen among school-age children 5 to 17 years. Then we had a quiescent period over the summer, and here's the fall outbreak that occurred in October, and now we're back down again.
Could I ask you the extent to which you get data from ambulatory care, say?
There are a couple of outpatient networks that we get data from. I think UW Physicians and MultiCare, there are many large networks that we don't get data from. So our ambulatory non-emergency room data is not nearly as representative as our emergency room data is.
Can I ask you a question on this graph?
Sure.
With all the media hype around H1N1, I'm assuming that just the overall volume got frightened, I'm assuming. Uh-huh. People got frightened, probably came in more. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how you kind of normalize for other factors besides, that's sort of obvious one, but I'm assuming there are more.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that was a particular issue at the beginning of the spring outbreak, where we had a lot of patients who were worried well, so to speak, particularly parents of children with flu, and they've read about this mysterious strain in Mexico that has caused unexpected deaths in young adults. And so, of course, their child has a fever, and they're worried, you know, does my child have the flu? Whereas, you know, 2 weeks ago, for the same illness, they would have just kept their child home from school a few days and let them get better on their own. So one of the shortcomings of the syndromic surveillance system is that we don't have a way of teasing apart those patients who have more severe illness from those who have more mild illness, unless that severity translates into a different disposition, such as being admitted to the hospital. So the syndromic surveillance system gives us an idea of sort of the volume of patients seen in emergency rooms, but it doesn't really tell us what type of influenza is out in the community. And for that, we rely on our Sentinel provider system. So scattered throughout King County, there's a network of, I want to say, a dozen to a dozen and a half clinics. Hall Health is one of them, that each week they agree to take a subset of people who come through their door with symptoms of flu and do a nasopharyngeal swab. And if you've never had this done on yourself, it's quite an experience. Yes, the swab really does go all the way that far back into your nose. But that's where flu virus lives and replicates, and so that's where we want to get the swab to be able to send to our laboratory to culture. So our Sentinel providers do this on a handful of patients each day. A handful of patients each week. And they send the swabs to the Public Health Seattle King County Laboratory. And our laboratory tries to grow whatever viruses are on those swabs. And each week they send us the spreadsheet. So this is a spreadsheet that lists the different respiratory viruses that have been isolated through our Sentinel Provider Program. And so you can see here back in October, we had, a lot of cases of influenza A, 2009 H1N1, as well as
some cases of influenza A that either the subtype couldn't be determined, or maybe we just had a positive rapid test for influenza. We never could grow a virus out of the sample. But now you can see here, at the end of January, we've just had a handful of people with flu. And then throughout the season, we've had a smattering of other respiratory illnesses as well, adenovirus, parainfluenza virus, respiratory syncytial virus. And if we graph the different flu strains seen in our sentinel network, this is what we see. So this is going back to January 2009. You can see, again, similar to what we saw in our syndromic surveillance system, in February and March, we had a peak of seasonal influenza, with the green being influenza type B, some influenza A. And then in April and May of 2009, we see orange here, which represents novel influenza H1N1. Again, a quiet period over the summer, and then our fall outbreak. So we suspect that these patients that presented with influenza A of an unknown subtype are probably almost all novel H1N1, even though we couldn't prove that. So this is one of the strengths of our Sentinels Provider Program, the ability to tell us what flu strains are circulating in the community. It doesn't really give us a good measure of impact. If you were to look at this, you would be led to believe that the seasonal influenza outbreak in February and March of 2009 was just as severe as the spring outbreak, when in fact we know from the graph of emergency room visits that's not true, that the spring outbreak, you know, was much more severe in terms of the number of people who sought health care.
Could I ask the degree to which the findings that the laboratory gets from those swabs that get sent in get sent back to the practitioner to put in the patient's health records so that it's noted that at least there was a detected A strain or an H1 strain?
Right, yeah. That's an excellent question, and it kind of points to the different uses of data that data collected for public health purposes is sometimes very different from that collected for patient care purposes. So these viral culture results, there's probably a lag of about a week from the time that it gets collected from the patient to the time that it gets sent to our laboratory and then grown in culture. So that's not very helpful to the physician who's seeing the patient in clinic. For most of us, if we get sick with the flu, we're going to get better without any treatment at all. But for those of us who have a chronic illness, say diabetes or asthma, or if we have a more severe illness, if we're going to benefit from antiviral medications, ideally those antiviral medications should be started within the first 48 hours of our illness. So having a culture result a week after we've been to the doctors, you know, is not going to help. So the Sentinel providers collect this data knowing that it's for public health purposes and knowing that it's probably not going to be much help in terms of, you know, caring for their own patients. And so for that, they rely on their own clinical judgment to diagnose flu, as well as you know, the rapid flu tests that they have available in their office. So to get information on the most severe cases of flu, namely those who are admitted to the hospital, we rely on healthcare providers and the infection control programs of hospitals in King County to report to us patients who are admitted with laboratory-confirmed influenza. So the way this works is when they find out that a patient has been admitted, the infection control practitioner goes to the medical record and gets the information to fill out on this form, this paper form, downloaded from the public health website or the Washington State Department of Health website. And then they fax it to us, and then we enter the data into our databases. There's two databases. There's our communicable disease database, which accepts some basic demographic data, data on disease classification and type, occupation,
and maybe some limited clinical information. You know, did the patient die? Was the patient admitted to the hospital? You know, were they in a sensitive occupation? You know, for instance, are they a healthcare worker who's at risk of spreading influenza or another communicable disease to their patients? And then we also enter data from that paper form into FIMS, which stands for the Public Health Issue Management System. And this is a database that's run by the Washington State Department of Health. And all of the fields that are on that paper form that I showed you can get entered into this database. So it's much more complete than the amount of data that can be entered. However, unlike our own in-house database, it's very difficult to get data out of it. So in order for us to have data to use locally here in King County, we maintain our own database, even though we have this database at the state that's in many ways very powerful. Of course, this leads to problems of double data entry. I mean, it's bad enough with having to enter data into a system once in terms of instead of electronically transferring data. So we know there's going to be errors in mistyping and misclassification. But then that to do it into two databases kind of compounds the problem. So in recognition of that, one thing that we offered during the winter outbreak was the option to report cases to us by an Excel spreadsheet. So we sent out a spreadsheet with these variable names and definitions to different hospitals, and we told them, if you create an Excel spreadsheet like this and send it to us each week, you don't have to fill out the paper forms. So this is a spreadsheet just with the variable definitions, but imagine that there's another page to the spreadsheet with one column for facility, one column for medical record number, one column for first name, a column for last name, et cetera. So we thought that hospitals would be eager to do this, and we had a method of secure file transfer so that they would be able to send this spreadsheet full of protected health information to us in a way that would protect patient confidentiality. But unfortunately, we only had a few hospitals take us up on this. Very few hospitals had information technology resources, developers really, programmers, who they could devote to creating an automatic system to generate this spreadsheet. Other hospitals said, yes, please feel free to use this spreadsheet, but you'll have to do it manually. So the infection control practitioners decided, well, let's see, should I fill out a paper? What's worse, filling out a paper case report form in each individual patient, or maintaining the spreadsheet in all the patients that we've seen this week? And so some hospitals chose the paper method, some hospitals chose this electronic method.
So did anyone automate it?
One hospital did, yeah. And the experience was equivocal, and I'll talk about that a little bit later.
Could you comment on how both state and county collection of data has made use of the recent conventions during the last year that the Public Information Technology Standards Panel has put together in the ONC program? Because for some years they've been talking about the National Health Information Network, and getting all of this stuff so that the data can be abstracted. You don't need to have people put on forms and then people enter it into spreadsheets.
Right,
that sort of thing. And I was kind of curious to the extent to which the county and state were working towards that end.
Right. I think this is one of those situations where both the county and the state share that vision and share that goal, but neither the county nor the state has the resources to carry it out. So they're
really working at that right at the moment, are they?
Correct, yeah. So I think there's a lot of planning that's taken place and that is taking place. FIMS is FIN compliant. However, at present, it's not able to import data in electronic form. Our database is able to very easily export data, but it's not FIN compliant. So, I think one one important project that we'd like to pursue, you know, if and when we get the resources to do that, is to develop that, that data pipe from the county to the state. In terms of, so that's for hospitalizations. What about deaths? Deaths that occur in the hospital will be reported by the hospital infection control practitioners. But what about deaths that occur outside the hospital? And so for that, we rely on the medical examiner's office to tell us when they hear of a death that's due to influenza, or if they have a death that they suspect is from influenza, then they carry out an investigation, an autopsy, and collect specimens for viral culture to try to determine, you know, did this patient die of flu? So if we combine that information from the hospitals with information on deaths and admissions, with information from the medical examiner's office with information on deaths, from the spring and the fall outbreaks, this is what we get. So the color coding is just the same as the Sentinel provider graph that I showed you earlier. The crosshatch are the numbers of deaths in that particular subtype. So you can see that in the spring, we had quite a few hospitalizations, but no more than, you know, a dozen or so each week. But then here for the fall outbreak, we saw quite a huge increase in influenza activity in terms of hospital admissions and more deaths. But again, also we see that except for a few sporadic cases of influenza B, it's almost all due to 2009 H1N1 or influenza A that's not subtyped, but that we presume to be pandemic influenza. The other way we have to conduct surveillance on deaths due to influenza is through the Vital Statistics Office. So each week they go through their death certificates and find those that have either pneumonia or influenza listed as a cause of death or a contributing factor, and they send us copies of those certificates, as well as the number of those certificates, as well as the total number of deaths, and so that way we can determine what proportion of deaths in King County in a particular week were due to pneumonia and influenza, and we then send that to the state, who sends that to the CDC. And this is the graph that they create each week, where the red line represents proportion of deaths due to pneumonia and influenza. This dark sinusoidal line at the bottom is the seasonal baseline, and the dark upper line is the epidemic threshold. So crossing that presumably means something abnormal is happening. But as you can see, it bounces around so much, it's in any given week, it's really hard to know how to interpret that number. Another source of information we have is from hospital laboratories. So the Sentinel Provider Clinic gives us information on rapid antigen tests and viral cultures from a subset of patients who come to their clinics. But what about for the county as a whole? How many people outside of hospitals are doing rapid tests for influenza? So each week, hospital laboratories enter the number of tests, rapid antigen tests that they've done, along with aggregate numbers, say the number positive for influenza A, the number positive for influenza B, and they enter that into a website run by the State Department of Health, and then we download that into our local influenza database, and this is what we get. So this is rapid antigen tests done since October 2009, where the dotted line is the number of tests that were submitted to laboratories, and this dark line here are the number of positive tests. And so you can see several hundred tests were done each week at the height of the outbreak in October, let's see, what would you say, maybe 10% positive at the peak, and now things have come down a bit. This gray line here is the historical average, so you can see in the course of a regular flu season, most of the tests are done in February and March.
So it'll be interesting to see if we're going to have a third wave of influenza. I don't know if you remember the graph that I showed at the very beginning of the 1918 pandemic. There was a spring wave, a large fall wave in October, and then there was a third spring wave in 1919. So we're all curious to know if 2009 H1N1 will do the same here in King County. So if you haven't gotten vaccinated against 2009 H1N1, it's not too late. And actually, one of the things that may influence whether or not we have a third wave is the proportion of the population immunized against pandemic flu. So go out and get vaccinated. You could help prevent the third wave of pandemic flu in King County. So children play a special role in the transmission of influenza. So anybody who's a parent or anybody who spends time around children knows that if a child that you spend a lot of time with gets sick, you're not too far behind. And so it's useful for us to know how is influenza impacting the schools. And so for that, we ask schools to report, K through 12 schools to report to us their absenteeism information each day. And they do this through an organization called WSITSE, for the Washington School Information Processing Cooperative. So they're a cooperative that handles the information needs of many, many school districts, not all, but many in the state. Everything from report cards to human resources to absenteeism. And so WSITSE has been doing this for many, many years and agreed to export their absenteeism data with the school district's blessing to us each day. So this gets sent to us, and then we process it, and we can tell for each grade what percentage of students were absent on any given day. And it's imprecise because the system doesn't tell us if a student was absent because they went on a vacation with their parents, or if they're absent because of vomiting and diarrhea, or if they're absent with the flu. But we have seen that school absenteeism does go up and down with flu activity and correlates pretty well. So this is a graph of school absenteeism in elementary schools. Each row here represents a different week. So the week ending January 9th, January 16th, January 23rd, January 30th. And so you can see for this most recent week, 96% of schools had less than 10%, 96% of elementary schools in King County had less than 10% absenteeism. And we had maybe 4% of schools with 10 to 20% absenteeism. And different grades have different patterns of absenteeism. So for middle schools, we see a little bit more absenteeism at baseline, independent of flu. So here in this most recent week, 96% with less than 10% absenteeism, a few percent with 10 to 20% absenteeism, and then 1% with 21 to 30% absenteeism in middle schools. And then for high schools, I guess a lot of kids skip in class. We have 60% with less than 10% absenteeism, 2% with greater than 40% absenteeism. And so this is something we see at baseline, and it varies a lot from school to school how much absenteeism is seen at baseline, you know, without the influence of flu. Whether or not this is some artifact of student registration or something else, we're not really sure. But at least if things go up and down, we can try to draw inferences from that information. We're also interested in the other end of the age spectrum, in other words, how influenza affects the elderly population. So we ask nursing homes and long-term care facilities to report outbreaks amongst their residents. And this is done for a couple reasons. One is that seasonal influenza tends to impact the elderly more than other age groups. And the other is that when there is an outbreak in a nursing home, there are some very specific interventions that can be done
to reduce the spread to other patients. For instance, putting patients who haven't been infected and haven't been immunized on antiviral medications to prevent their becoming infected. So that's all the different components of getting information into our flu surveillance system. I'll just talk a little bit about how we get information out. So we get information out through our website. And so we have information on vaccines, we have treatment guidelines, we have diagnosis and reporting guidelines. We also send out alerts to healthcare providers by email. So we send an email with a PDF attachment. This is one that was sent in mid-September with recommendations for who we wanted healthcare providers and hospitals to report to us. You know, what kind of patients we wanted them to count and fill out a report form for. A problem with this system is that we don't really have a way of knowing if it's getting to our intended audience. So you would think that that it would be easy to have a somebody in the state or the county must have a good database of licensed healthcare providers that they'd be willing to share. And that we could just upload this database into our alert system and send things out. But actually, that's not the case. So we rely on trying to spread the word at conferences and through email to try to get healthcare providers to sign up for our email alerts. But the other problem, as with any of you who have spent time in a hospital know, is that oftentimes you're just too busy to check your email through the in the course of a day, and so it might be that email alerts really aren't all that useful for healthcare workers in hospitals anyway. And so we need some other way of getting information about public health issues to healthcare providers on the front line. So now that we've gone through all the different components, let's just kind of quickly go through our surveillance system and grade ourselves on the different characteristics that we talked about. How were we in terms of simplicity? It wasn't very simple, but I think given the technology we have today, we probably need all these different streams of information in order to capture different impacts on our community. One difficulty that we had is it's hard to get follow-up on reported cases. So say you go to the hospital and are admitted for the flu. The day you're admitted, the infection control practitioner in the hospital will fill out a case report form on you and fax it to us, and we'll put it in our database. But say 2 days later, you get worse and you wind up in the intensive care unit. Although we as a public health program are interested in knowing what proportion of our patients in the hospital have severe illness requiring intensive care, we don't have any way of knowing that you've just gotten transferred to the intensive care unit. The infection control practitioners were often too busy with their regular duties to give us a call and say, just to let you know, so-and-so was transferred to the ICU. Also, we don't know when you got better and when you got discharged. We probably have a good way of finding out if about fatal influenza cases. Hospitals are pretty good about letting us know about that. But other than giving hospitals a call every week to find out, okay, this patient that you reported last week, you know, how are they doing? Did they wind up in the ICU? It's pretty hard to get follow-up information on those cases. As I mentioned, we thought that electronic spreadsheet reporting might be an answer to the difficulty with paper forms, but few hospitals were able to give IT support to their infection control program to implement this. And many infection control nurses just didn't have the background and experience with Microsoft Excel to be able to fill out these spreadsheets. Yes?
What proportion of hospitals do have infection control people that are trained in infection control reporting?
Well, every hospital infection control program works with public health. So apart from flu, if they have a case of a notifiable condition, say E. coli or Salmonella, in their hospital, it's the infection control nurse who will tell us about it. So every hospital has that. But not every hospital has, say, an infection control nurse who's a whiz at Excel or Microsoft Access, you know, who can pull off this, you know, maintaining a spreadsheet like this. And not every hospital, really only one hospital, was willing to say, okay, here's a computer programmer that you can use to develop the spreadsheet that you can have automatically generate a list of influenza patients to send to Seattle King County each week. And the one hospital that did, we found that you know, when there was, say, a change in the reporting form, say we wanted to make sure that whether the patient was a healthcare worker was reported, just adding that column was something that took a long time to do. So the surveillance system wasn't very flexible in that regard. Also, it was just a challenge in general to make sure that hospitals always had the most up-to-date version of the report form to use. This is less of a problem in the fall than in the spring. In the spring, things were so unknown that, and our data collection was changing every week that there's probably a new form, you know, every few days. And so we didn't have that problem in the fall, but it was still a challenge to make sure that everybody was using the most up-to-date form. We had some hospitals tell us that that they were getting close to the limit of volume they could handle in terms of the numbers of patients that they could fill out all this case report data on. And so one question about flexibility is, you know, what would have happened if say, we had twice the volume of hospitalizations than what we saw in the fall? What would hospitals have done if without enough infection control staff to go around getting this information? How would they have told public health about hospitalizations? Well, one idea was, well, maybe public health could make response teams that we could send to different hospitals and help them collect the data. But as you know, to access a hospital medical record system requires, you know, quite a bit of training and know-how. And hospitals might be too busy in the heat of an event to train the trainer response team on how to get the information. So that's a big question mark. How we would handle large volumes that would overwhelm hospitals. How did we do with accuracy? Well, one of the findings from the spring outbreak was that minority populations in King County were impacted by pandemic influenza more than the general population. But answering this question for the fall is difficult. In the spring, we telephoned almost every single hospitalization and asked them the questions on the case report form, including, you know, what is your race and what is your ethnicity. For the fall, we had hospitals transmit the information to us, but not all hospital registration systems collect race information and ethnicity information. So right away, we're starting off with incomplete data. As I mentioned, we had problems with double data entry. And we just finished data quality assurance checks on our fall surveillance data to date. And we found very few records that were 100% complete and accurate. Almost every single record had some missing data or some data that was that had something different entered into the computer than what was on our paper report form. So was our surveillance system acceptable? Probably we're getting close to the limits. Many infection control nurses expressed frustration with having to fill out these paper forms when they were so busy having to deal with influenza on the wards. One hospital described the spreadsheet system as laborious. Another way in which the system was kind of borderline in terms of acceptability was how our medical examiner investigated deaths due to suspected influenza. The Centers for Disease Control did have a protocol, but it was more geared towards research and special investigations, and really not tailored towards a busy medical examiner's office that's having to deal with deaths every day due to different causes. So we had to say, okay, forget this complicated protocol. Here's something very simple that doesn't require many resources that that you can do to at least try to identify rapidly those patients who have flu.
how are we in terms of sensitivity and specificity? Sensitivity, it's difficult to assess without some other source of data about influenza admissions to compare it to. In terms of specificity, that's kind of a question mark too, especially for our syndromic surveillance data coming to us each day from hospitals. So does a patient who is coded as having pneumonia in the syndromic surveillance system, were they truly diagnosed with pneumonia when they went to the emergency room? You know, I think that's something that we need to validate further to really be confident that we know that the data represents reality. Yeah.
Now, with that, then you might get to a timely, but did the syndromic surveillance data help you at all in terms of preparation, or what did you find its usefulness?
I think the greatest utility of the syndromic surveillance system was probably for situational awareness. So we could tell by kind of drilling down in different graphs, you know, which hospitals were the busiest, what age groups were the most impacted. And this was data that we could get updated every day. So even though the syndromic surveillance system might have been lacking in terms of sensitivity and specificity, we felt we had enough confidence in it to know, okay, it's showing us an increase in kids aged 5 to 17. You know, we have relative confidence that it really is school-age kids that are coming in the greatest numbers to emergency rooms. Representativeness. A decision was made early on that we would focus our efforts on the most severe cases of flu. So ideally, we'd have a surveillance system that would not only detect cases of influenza that wind up in hospitals, but maybe even those who are mild enough that they just go to the doctor and not need to go to the emergency room, not need to be admitted to a hospital. But we as a public health community, as a nation, just don't have the resources to test and monitor all the patients who show up with possible influenza in clinics. So sort of a calculated decision made at the beginning of the flu season was that we weren't going to have a representative surveillance system. We were going to focus on the most severe cases because that's what we were most interested in. We wanted to know basically who is at greatest risk of severe illness, who is at greatest risk of dying, and tailor public health interventions around that. I think in terms of timeliness, we did pretty well. You know, we got daily data from our syndromic surveillance system and weekly data from our Sentinel provider and laboratory surveillance systems. And I think we did pretty well in terms of stability. We really didn't have any large extended outages due to computer downtime or network downtime. We did find that laboratories needed a reminder just to kind of gently coax them into reporting each week. But otherwise, we had a pretty steady data flows from all of our different components. I think this is an area where with the prevalence of electronic medical records in hospitals today, that with just some more investment in our infrastructure, we could create a system that is more simple and more accurate. So right now we have different information pipes coming from different parts of the hospital to different databases in public health. What if we could integrate this with the electronic medical record that all these different components of the hospital, of the healthcare system feed into, and then just have one data pipe that distributes the information to different components in our health department. And maybe this could run in the background so that when a physician admits a patient with influenza and that patient has a positive laboratory test, the infection control nurse doesn't have to fill out any paperwork. Just in the background, that information gets transmitted to public health and imported into our databases. And so that's the ideal. It'll be expensive, but perhaps someday we'll be able to.
Can you outline a set of sort of basic features of electronic health record system that would provide the capabilities for the data abstraction for public health that you need?
We have not in King County, except for that spreadsheet that I showed you. So if a hospital were able to tap into its medical record and generate, you know, a spreadsheet, you know, with the fields that I showed you, you know, then we would be happy with that for flu surveillance. But anything more detailed than that, no. Well, I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions or take any comments. Yes?
With the emergency department, you compare as the data sources for syndromic surveillance. I wonder what is the method used in county to classify those two components specifically syndromic level?
So what is the data? What is the method used to classify the chief complaints of patients seen in emergency rooms? I think it just looks for keywords and key phrases in the chief complaint. So there aren't any complex natural language processing algorithms or anything like that. It just looks, you know, if does a chief complaint contain fever and cough or sore throat or various misspellings of those. Excuse me?
I mean, is it the method used in the company is that the keyword?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right, yes. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Any other questions or comments? Thanks for your time. Okay, thank you very much.
In terms of the biomedical health informatics issues with regard to electronic health records,
yeah,
that would tie into what the DHI program is doing. You know, we're trying to get the
that was more active involved.